From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!
I'm a 9/11 widow, and I feel that this commission was nothing but a cover-up, and most of the families have been bought off. And the only way for the truth is through my legal court action.
Ellen Mariani lost her husband on September 11th. She's turned down a possible $1.8 million from the U.S. government, and now she's filing suit against President Bush and his senior cabinet. Then Gore Vidal on Imperial America, the United States of Amnesia. We'll also hear his thoughts on 9/11.
I realize the country has totally changed, that the government is not responsive to the people, either in protecting us from something like 9/11, which they should have done, could have done, did not do. And then when it did happen, to investigate.
But first, we'll look at Ahmed Chalabi's fall from grace with the U.S. in Iraq. We'll talk with veteran journalist Andrew Coburn. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. The U.S. military has raided and ransacked the headquarters and home of Ahmed Chalabi in Baghdad. Chalabi, the head of the Iraqi National Congress and member of the Iraqi Governing Council, had once been the Bush administration's closest Iraqi ally. His Iraqi National Congress fed much of the fabricated and misleading intelligence to the U.S. government and press in the lead-up to the invasion of Iraq. The INC has received over $40 million in U.S. funding over the past 4 years alone. U.S. officials said Chalabi is under investigation for sharing top-secret U.S. intelligence documents with foreign governments, including Iran, that could put American lives in jeopardy. In addition, 15 employees of Chalabi are reportedly under investigation for taking part in kidnappings, torture, embezzlement, and the theft of government property. The Washington Post reports the U.S. has been investigating the INC for possible ties to a scheme to defraud the Iraqi government during the transition to a new currency that took place last year. Chalabi had also distanced himself from Washington and had become highly critical of the occupation. The raid occurred at dawn Thursday morning. U.S. forces, with help from the FBI, CIA, and Iraqi police, surrounded his house and headquarters. Files, rifles, and computers were seized. The U.S. attempted to downplay their involvement and claim Iraqi police led the raid. At one point, Paul Bremer's chief spokesperson, Dan Senor, said, quote, "We really don't have anything to do with the investigation or the arrests, but all reports from Iraq indicate the U.S. was entirely behind it." Adnan Pachaki, who serves on the U.S.-appointed Iraqi Governing Council, disputed the U.S. claim. "Of course they knew," he said. After the raid, Chalabi cut off his ties with the Iraqi Governing Council. The council plans to hold an emergency meeting today in response to the raid. We'll have more on this in just a few minutes. New details in the prison torture scandal in Iraq have emerged. As well, the Washington Post has obtained hundreds of more photos of abuse, as well as sworn statements by detainees at Abu Ghraib describing the torture. One photo showed a naked prisoner who appears to be covered in excrement paraded down a hallway. Another shows a U.S. soldier beating detainees sprawled on the floor. A video shows a prisoner slamming his head repeatedly into a metal door that he's shackled to until he collapses. In sworn testimony, prisoners have reported they were force-fed pork and alcohol against their Muslim religion. One detainee said a soldier asked him if he believed in anything. The prisoner said, quote, "I said to him, I believe in Allah. So he said, but I believe in torture and I will torture you." Then the soldier hit the detained man who had a broken leg and ordered him to curse Islam. The prisoner said, "Because they started to hit my broken leg, I curse my religion. They ordered me to thank Jesus I'm alive." NBC News is reporting another prison scandal may soon be emerging. The Pentagon is now investigating charges of abuse carried out by the Army's elite Delta Force at a top secret site near the Baghdad airport. According to some U.S. officials, the most egregious violations of the Geneva Conventions took place at this site where top-level Iraqi suspects are held. According to NBC, the normal rules of interrogation don't apply here. As soon as detainees are brought in, hoods are put over their heads. The detainees are routinely drugged. Prisoners are held underwater until they think they're drowning, and some are smothered to the point of near suffocation. In related news on Capitol Hill, the House voted 308 to 114 Thursday to tear down the Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq, and some 400 more prisoners at Abu Ghraib were released today. In other news from Iraq, up to 42 Iraqis died on Wednesday when the U.S. attacked a wedding party near the Syrian border. The Guardian of London interviewed some of the survivors who reported 27 of those killed were from one family. 14 of them children, 11 women. Also killed was Hussein al-Ali, who is one of the most popular singers in western Iraq. One survivor who lost her two boys in the attack said, quote, "The bombing started at 3 a.m. We went out of the house and the American soldiers started to shoot us. They were shooting low on the ground and targeting us one by one." Another witness said, quote, "I saw something that nobody ever saw in this world. There were children's bodies cut into pieces, women cut into pieces, men cut into pieces." The U.S. has admitted there was a raid on the village, but said it was to target a, quote, "suspected foreign fighter safe house." Brigadier General Mark Kimmett, Deputy Director of Operations for the U.S. military in Iraq, said, quote, "We took ground fire and we returned fire. We estimate around 40 were killed, but we operated within our rules of engagement," he said. A Marine commander disputed the Iraqi assertion that the U.S. had raided a wedding party, but when he was asked about a video showing a child's body being lowered into a grave, he said, quote, "I have not seen the pictures, but bad things happen in wars. I don't have to apologize for the conduct of my men." The Bush administration is asking the U.N. Security Council for an extension on immunity from prosecution of any of its soldiers or citizens from the International Criminal Court. Last year, the Council adopted a similar resolution unanimously under U.S. threat to veto U.S. peacekeeping missions. This year, Brazil, Spain, Germany, and France are expected to abstain. The International Criminal Court was set up to try perpetrators of genocide, mass war crimes, and systematic human rights abuses. An Iraqi cameraman working with Al Jazeera and eight other civilians have been killed in fighting in the holy city of Karbala. This according to a report by Agence France-Presse. The journalist Hamid Rashid Wali was filming the fighting from his hotel window when he was shot. AFP reports 15 journalists have been killed so far this year in Iraq. All but two have been Iraqi. The Committee to Protect Journalists recently named Iraq to be the most dangerous country in the world for journalists. In Gaza, there are reports the Israeli military is pulling out of Rafah, where it has conducted a massive assault over the last 3 days. The BBC has described the offensive as one of the largest ever in Gaza. At least 41 Palestinians were killed over the past 3 days. Homes were demolished, city streets were ripped up, and the BBC reports even the town zoo was destroyed. Israel's actions were widely condemned by the international community. Meanwhile, in Tel Aviv, the Palestinian legislator Marwan Barghouti, who was once seen as a possible successor to Yasser Arafat, was convicted on 5 counts of murder by an Israeli court. Barghouti rejected the charges and said, quote, "This is a court of occupation that I do not recognize." The prosecution is seeking to hand him 5 life sentences. You can go to our website at democracynow.org to listen or watch Tuesday and Wednesday's programs. On Wednesday, we brought you a live report from the Rafah hospital after Israeli gunships attacked the Palestinian protesters in the streets. The nonpartisan General Accounting Office has determined the Bush administration engaged in illegal covert propaganda by making and distributing videos to TV stations that appeared to be real news segments lauding the benefits of the new Republican-written Medicare legislation. In Miami, a federal judge has acquitted Greenpeace in its trial brought by the Justice Department. Greenpeace was facing criminal charges under an obscure 19th century sailing law after two of its members boarded a boat illegally transporting mahogany. If Greenpeace had been convicted, First Amendment lawyers predicted it would send a chilling message to all activist groups. In Washington, the Justice Department has taken the unusual step of retroactively classifying information it gave to Congress in open session 2 years ago pertaining to the case of Sybil Edmonds. Edmonds is a former FBI translator who charged on Democracy Now! And other news programs that FBI had information before September 11th that indicated an al-Qaeda attack was imminent. FBI officials gave Senate staffers two briefings in 2002 concerning Edmonds. Now they want to classify the content of those meetings. Republican Senator Charles Grassley of Iowa told the New York Times, quote, "What the FBI is up to here is ludicrous. To classify something that's already been out in the public domain, what do you accomplish?" he asked. He said it does harm to transparency in government, and it looks like an attempt to cover up the FBI's problems in translating intelligence. The Justice Department is classifying the types of cases Edmonds handled, the employees she worked with, where she worked, and even what languages she translated. Edmonds, who speaks fluent Farsi and Turkish, was hired shortly after September 11th to translate intelligence that the agency had received in the months leading up to September 11th. In addition to classifying the contents of the 2002 hearing, the Justice Department is also trying to block Edmonds from testifying in a lawsuit connected to 9/11. You can go to our website at democracynow.org, and you can hear the conversation Sybil Edmonds has had on this program. And hundreds of people protested, and five were arrested at Halliburton's shareholders meeting in Houston on Wednesday. Protesters decried Halliburton's close connections to Vice President Cheney, which had led to $18 billion in profits from contracts in Iraq.
Come, you masters of war. Here that build the big guns. Here that build the death planes. Here that build all the bombs. Here that hide behind walls. Here that hide behind disks. I just don't want you to know I can see through your masks. You that never done nothing but build to destroy. You play with my world like it's your little toy. You put a gun in my hand and you hide from my eyes. And you turn and run farther when the fast bullets fly.
Bob Dylan, Masters of War. Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And good day to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world on the internet.
Well, we're moving right into our first segment today. In dawn raids yesterday, American troops and Iraqi police surrounded the headquarters and home of one of Washington's top allies in Iraq, Ahmed Chalabi, head of the Iraqi National Congress. U.S. troops put a gun to his head, arrested two of his aides, and seized documents.
Only 5 months ago, Chalabi was a guest of honor sitting right behind Laura Bush at the State of the Union address of President Bush. What brought about this astonishing fall from grace of the man who helped provide the faked intelligence that justified last year's war? That is the question posed by veteran independent journalist and author Andrew Coburn in a new piece on counterpunch.org. He joins us on the line from Washington, D.C.
Welcome, Andrew.
Good morning.
It's good to have you with us. So tell us what you think is going on right now with Ahmed Chalabi.
Well, Chalabi, obviously relations between Chalabi and the his former pals in Washington have been deteriorating, not with his core group of supporters among the neoconservatives who've actually continued to support him and right up through yesterday, indeed, people like Richard Perle, but with the occupation in general, things have been going downhill. Part of the reason is that Chalabi has been, in order to give himself, try and get some political foothold in Iraq, has been comporting himself more and more as an extreme Shia, as a sort of taking a sectarian position, denouncing the UN, conducting a campaign against the UN in the form of the oil for food scandal, and just generally, you know, being a real thorn in their side. So I think they finally got fed up with him.
But now this is obviously a marked departure on his side from how he came into Iraq with U.S. forces. Could you go a little bit over some of the Chalabi's history? We've discussed it on Democracy Now! In the past, but going back to his financial scandals previously and his financial support by the United States government?
Sure. I mean, he's Chalabi, sort of his first public role. Well, let me just sketch in the background. His family, up till the 1958 revolution, were the richest family in Iraq. They controlled enormous amounts of property and banks and so forth. And that they'd really done that by combining business and politics. They'd use political advantage to make money and use their money to gain more political advantage. So then they're driven out and they go to Lebanon. And then in the 70s, Ahmed starts this bank in the Petra Bank in Jordan, which is very successful for a while. Partly, I'd love him to have been my bank manager because he would lend money basically on sort of no security to France. In 1989, the bank went bust. Ahmed fled the country, many say, in the trunk of a friend's car, though he hates you to say that. When they looked at the books of the bank, he was just a classic tale of fraud and embezzlement and greed. And the Jordanians convicted him in absentia to 22 years in jail. But meanwhile, the CIA had picked him up and put him in charge of this thing they'd invented called the Iraqi National Congress. And this is right after the first Gulf War. And he stayed on the payroll one way or another up till last week. And the point about Chalabi is that he's out for Ahmed Chalabi. So he was never loyal to the Americans particularly, but he used the Americans and the Americans used him. He also used the Iranians and the Iranians used him. He also used the Israelis and the oil companies and anyone else who had given him an advantage. He discovered, he's very shrewd, very smart guy. He discovered in the late 90s, really, is when he came to the realization that there was a tremendous appetite, particularly in the media here, for quote-unquote intelligence about Iraq. And basically, any sort of vaguely coherent tale he wanted to spin would be equally lapped up by the likes of Judy Miller in the New York Times and many others. So, he was fantastically useful in greasing the skids for war. But then, once the war had happened, to get any kind of political credibility for himself in Iraq, he had to try and show that he wasn't just an American stooge, which is what he's been trying to do.
But now, also, don't we have the problem that he has numerous people within the existing government now that are close to him? That what is the United States going to do with these allies of Chalabi now that are still within the provisional authorities' government structure?
Precisely. I mean, he is laced. He is, because he's a very good, networker. I mean, he's got a lot of people who are beholden to him in the, what you call the sort of fledgling Iraqi administration. I mean, I can name the Minister of Finance, Kamil Gailani, is generally very regarded as being his acolyte. He used to be a sort of former waiter in a Jordanian restaurant. The Minister of Oil, Ibrahim Baraloum. The heads of the central bank, the leaders of some of the other important banks. I mean, in a very short space of time, he has managed to set up this network, political come sort of business and financial network in Baghdad that's going to be very hard to winkle out, assuming anyone really wants to do so.
Can you talk about the allegations that he's giving confidential U.S. Information documents to Iran and his relationship with al-Sadr?
Well, on Iran, I mean, his relationship to Iran goes back a very long way. He's told friends in the past that he actually has a Quran autographed very affectionately by Ayatollah Khomeini in return for services rendered during the Iran-Iraq war. And I know that during that war, he while he was a banker in Jordan, was regarded by U.S. diplomats and intelligence as a very useful source of information about what was going on the Iranian side in the war. In the 90s, I mean, Scott Ritter told me, the former U.N. inspector, that Chalabi boasted to him of his fantastic Iranian connections and offered to introduce the U.N. inspectors to the head of Iranian intelligence, told him that his best intelligence actually came from the Iranians. And I found evidence that at least some of the fake intelligence that Chalabi was helping pass to the to intelligence people here and to the UN inspectors came from Iran. There was a specific case of a forged document that purported to show an Iraqi nuclear program because of certain terms that were used in it had to have been constructed in Iran. So this goes back a long way. So it comes as no surprise to me that he's now accused of passing American secrets to Iran. I mean, the thing about Chalabi is that, you know, he'll be an agent for anyone. I mean, he's I'm sure you could find just as good evidence of him, you know, passing stuff, you know, helping the Israelis or the oil companies or the Turks or anyone, because, you know, Ahmed Chalabi is out for Ahmed Chalabi.
We are talking to Andrew Coburn. He is co-author with his brother Patrick Coburn of Out of the Ashes, The Resurrection of Saddam Hussein, talking about Ahmed Chalabi, his latest piece, Ahmed Chalabi's Failed Coup. The U.S. raids his home and headquarters in Iraq to foil his plot. What do you see as his future right now?
Well, I mean, generally people are sort of disposed to write his political obituary right now, which I think is a bit of a mistake. As I mentioned earlier, he's been sort of carving out a position himself as sort of Mr. Shia. And, you know, in a way, this may well do him some good. I mean, he's not that far from Muqtada al-Sadr as a sort of spokesman or a would-be spokesman for representative of the Shia masses. And there are, you know, several Iraqis I've talked to think it's not unlikely that if anything happens to Muqtada al-Sadr, that Chalabi will at least try and step into that breach, be the spokesman for the disenfranchised Shia. I mean, some of what he's been doing the last few months has been actually quite sort of scary in terms of, you know, everyone's worried about Shia-Sunni conflict, the possibility of that, and obviously whoever's letting off these suicide bombs in Shia, you know, next to Shia shrines has been trying to foment that. Well, Chalabi, or at least certainly his sort of spokesman, have been actually taking a very sectarian line and sort of threatening civil war against the Sunnis at various times after these bombings. So I think we're going to see more of that. And it's possible, I don't say it's certain, but it's possible that now Chalabi can portray himself as a victim of the Americans and they've raided his house and so on and so forth, that you'll see, you know, a lot more sort of sectarian rhetoric coming from him, which may resonate in Iraq. I mean, obviously, I hope it doesn't, and it's not. I mean, Iraq is not, whatever people say here, I think, that close to civil war. But I think Chalabi will be doing its best to foment it.
Andrew Coburn, thanks very much for joining us. Independent journalist in Washington, D.C., his latest piece, published at counterpunch.org, is called The Truth About Ahmed Chalabi. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, a woman who lost her husband on September 11th has attended the 9/11 hearings this week in New York and is suing George Bush and his senior cabinet. Then Gore Vidal. Stay with us. Thank you. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. The Silence and the Sorrow, the music, Lauren Mazzacane Connors. Well, this week, the 9/11 Commission wrapped up its latest round of public hearings. Homeland Security Chief Tom Ridge and former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani were among the officials who testified at the hearings, which took place at New School University here in New York. Here is some of what the former mayor had to say.
We thought of a lot of things. We had plans for anthrax. We had plans for smallpox. We had plans for terrorist bombings. We had plans for dirty bombs, airplane crashes. But in all that thinking that we did, we had never come up with the thought that there would be planes used as missiles attacking buildings.
Mayor Rudolph Giuliani, while he may not have come up with that thought of missiles used as planes used as missiles, it is something that the FBI translator Sybil Edmonds has talked about repeatedly, saying that she was hired after 9/11 to look at the wiretap conversations that took place before, to translate them, and that in those conversations she could hear more than once that exact use of planes in the United States, that the government had been warned.
There were many protests outside the hearing this week and inside as well, with protesters disrupting the proceedings several times. Among those who were in town for the hearings were a number of family members who lost loved ones on September 11th. Tomorrow night at Riverside Church in New York, there will be a forum on what organizers are calling the unanswered questions surrounding 9/11. Among the speakers will be former Chief UN Weapons Inspector Scott Ritter, as well as Ellen Mariani, who lost her husband, Lewis, on September 11th. He was on board United Airlines Flight 175.
Ellen Mariani has refused to accept any money from the U.S. government's compensation fund, which could be as much as $1.8 million. Instead, she's filed suit against President Bush, Vice President Cheney, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, and other administration officials. The suit is filed under RICO, the Racketeering Influence Corrupt Organizations Act. We turn now to Ellen Mariani, joining us in our studio as well, Philip Berg, Ellen Mariani's lawyer on the phone with us, former Deputy Attorney General of Pennsylvania, former candidate for governor and for U.S. Senate. And we welcome you both to Democracy Now. Ellen, why have you chosen this route? And can you start off by just sharing your reaction to the hearing this week?
I was very disappointed. I had not attended any of the others. I felt that they were an insult to the family's intelligence, number one. They are saying, we're not here to blame. We're here to learn a lesson. Do we have to learn a lesson on 3,000 deaths? No, we do not. We feel that they are guilty. We want to get to the bottom of this. That is the only way any of us in this country will heal. Other than that, we're told it's going to happen again. What's going to happen? How do they know? And why is this going to happen? What have we learned?
Could you tell us why you chose this particular path? What made you decide, obviously, to reject the compensation offers of the government? And what led you to decide that there were these unanswered questions?
Within a month after Neil's death, my husband, I went to an attorney in Boston, and he gave me the whole outline of the Victims' Compensation Fund. But Mr. Kenneth Feinberg decided to wait till September 21st, to come out with this most highly complicated procedure, you know, on a chart of everybody's worth that had been killed. I couldn't put together the real reasons or the dots of why we would have to shut up for money. We can't heal. You will never heal without the truth. It's the truth that sets us free. When I saw that I wasn't getting any answers from the media, from anything I'd heard on television, and the most important thing is when I had attended the second hearing in New York, I had already put a lawsuit in on December 20th, 2001, against United. You know, Neil and I, we paid for safe destinations. He did not get it. He was abandoned. God knows what they did to them or who did to them in those planes. And I feel sorry for, if they're going through the pain that I'm going through, it is hell. I decided to put the lawsuit in. I want the truth. You cannot sleep at night knowing you're paid off to keep your mouth shut. No. Money, as you get older, is not going to take the place of your loved one. I put a lawsuit in against United. What did they do? The government come in and blocked all my evidence to have a lawsuit. And I waited 2.5 years for them to show me that they're sincere. They're going to get to the bottom of this. Like the president has said, so help me God, we will hunt them down and they will be punished. That is not what they were doing. They blocked everything. So 2.5 years of nothing, I put the lawsuit in. No one is above the law.
Philip Berg, can you describe the legal principles of this lawsuit taking on President Bush and his senior cabinet?
Sure. Thank you very much, Amy, for having us on. It's a real honor, first off, to be able to represent Ellen Mariani, who has the stamina and guts to proceed. You know, roughly we're 2.5 years after 9/11, and not one person has been accused of a crime. Not one person in the military has been brought up for court-martial. Where is the investigation? This is the one of the biggest disasters that ever happened to the United States, going along with the lines of Pearl Harbor, or some people raise the issue of slavery and things of that effect. But this is the biggest attack on American soil. And what's going on? Where's the investigation? The evidence has disappeared. All the ground zero has been cleaned out, but the steel has been taken away. It has been sent off to China. The just the facts of this, the legitimate facts, are unanswered. So we have filed the RICO action, which is the Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organization Act. It was an act created by Congress in the 1960s to go after the mafia, to go after the mob. And it's our position there's a mob in the White House. To be successful with the RICO action, you have to have a before, during, and after. And we believe that we have the facts, and we will be able to start getting the evidence that there was plans before for this to occur. The facts of that, the administration definitely had foreknowledge of 9/11. They failed to warn. They failed to prevent. And since then, there's been a massive cover-up. So you need certain predicate acts. You need certain things you have to do. Right now, we're dealing with some procedural issues, and hopefully the next couple of weeks, we're going to clean some of those issues up to come forth more in the public, and that's why we appreciate being on your show and other shows. The mass media is not handling 9/11. What we're looking for is the direct answers to legitimate questions, and we feel we can get those, and we feel the answers are there. We just don't understand the media not wanting to cover it. It's a very difficult issue, we know. I think the biggest problem is that the American public doesn't want to accept that their government, that their government was involved in something as detrimental as this. And if I may, very briefly, if we can go back to Operation Northwood, it was 1962, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, that's our military brass in this country, had a plan which is now declassified, and I'm not sure if it's on our website yet, but I'll make sure it is up on there. But Operation Northwood dealt with the fact that they had planned, our government had planned to cause destruction to American property, cause death and injury to American citizens, and to blame it on Cuba, to go to war with Cuba. I say the document's now declassified. President John F. Kennedy stopped that. John F. Kennedy stopped that, and because of that, that did not occur. If you would change the facts of Cuba and with Iraq, the situation is just about the same. If people look at the facts of 9/11, 9/11 could not have happened, without the complicity of the federal government. Basics going back, and I try to identify things that people can identify with, and this is how we'll put forth in our suit, is that in 1999, the golfer Payne Stewart, his plane went off course, and I'm sure many of your listeners will remember that. And I'm switching phones here. Maybe that's a little better. His plane went off course, and after it was off course 3.5 minutes, it was picked up by the FAA and NORAD or whoever else, and within 8.5 minutes, fighter jets were alongside his plane while it went off course. It was supposed to fly from Florida to Texas, and instead it flew from Florida out to the northern United States. The jets escorted that plane the entire way. They didn't have to deal with the issue, but it's reported that if that plane was going to crash into a populated area, they would have shot it down. So where were the fighter jets on 9/11? We know from Betty Ong and others that at 8:20 a.m. on 9/11, that the first plane, was hijacked. Two people had been stabbed. They didn't have control of that plane. She stayed on the phone, a stewardess, from 8:20 to 8:46 when lost contact, when her plane crashed into the World Trade Center. When it was flashed on the news that a plane accidentally hit the World Trade Center, that's what we were told. The government knew that it was not an accident. So even for a minute, if you'd say, well, the fighter jets should, you know, why weren't they scrambled during that time? Why weren't they scrambled at 8:46? If they were, Ellen's husband, Neil, would probably not be alive today. But that second plane didn't hit the second World Trade Center until 17 minutes later. So where were the fighter jets? That plane should never have been allowed into the airspace of New York, or if it did, it should have ended up in the Hudson River someplace else. That plane was the second plane that hit, and that was the first tower that came down. These questions have not been asked by the 9/11 Commission. The 9/11 Commission is a joke because it's going to be like the Warren Commission, just smoothing over something without asking the legitimate, honest, direct questions that have to be asked.
Well, Philip Berg, the families and Ellen as well have asked for a variety of questions that have not been answered. One of the interesting ones is the issue of Governor Jeb Bush in Florida going to the offices of Hoffman Aviation School and ordering that flight records and files be removed. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. The stories which have been confirmed that Jeb Bush went to that flight school. All the records from there were taken and loaded onto an Air Force plane, I believe it was a C-130, and was flown out of the country. I mean, why? Talking about flying them out of the country when everyone, when all of your listeners, Ellen Mariani was stuck in Chicago, when people after 9/11 were grounded for 4 days, 3 or 4 days, President Bush allowed planes to go around the United States and pick up members of the Bin Laden family and other Saudis, and fly them out of the country without being investigated by the FBI or the CIA. Jeb Bush raises questions. The other thing, I believe, and I have to get the transcript, I was listening the other day when Mayor Giuliani was speaking, I believe he said when he was speaking with the White House, and I need the transcript, if you have it, please make it available to me, that there were 7 planes missing at a certain period of time. Well, if there were, the next question I have is, when they grounded all the planes in the United States, why those 7 planes, which they knew were off course, why weren't they earmarked and why weren't they held at a certain location at the airports where they were grounded to be searched and investigated? I mean, if you just think of all the things that have occurred here, Building 7 in New York, Building 7, a plane did not hit it, a 47-story building, in the World Trade Center complex, concrete and steel, and what happens at 5:30 in the afternoon on 9/11? The building implodes. Why? So these legitimate questions, and Ellen has raised many more, they're on our website, if I can mention it, www.9114thetruth.com. And they're legitimate questions that really have to be answered, which the government refuses to answer.
And I'd like to ask Ellen now, in terms of the families, how are the families moving forward now, especially after these last commission hearings?
Well, that's a good question. They're very sad. They feel devastated. They want answers. I want answers. A lot of them have confessed to me, and I don't condemn it. They're on medication. They have been on it for a long time, since 9/11. I want to tell you people, I am of sound mind. I would not take any medication. I was tricked into trying to be medicated, and no thank you. I wanted to take this on head on in respect of my husband and all those precious young people that died in the buildings and all those other victims from 80 other countries. My sympathy goes for them.
And what kind of access do you have to the 9/11 Commission members? Are these questions going to be answered, addressed?
Well, they're not answering any of our questions. To me, it's just a format. It's like a practice run. They wouldn't stay on for the second day for the questions and answers. time. They just decided, they just admitted it. We need answers from them. They say we're not here to blame, but to learn lessons. We don't need to learn lessons. You know, these people that died, my husband, precious little children on planes, they're heroes. Well, did they choose to be heroes? What had they done to become heroes? You know, don't soften, you know, this era by saying heroes. I would like my husband back, and I'll never see him again.
The questions, again, on your open letter to President Bush, why were 29 pages of the 9/11 committee report personally censored at your request? What are the black boxes from Flight 11 and Flight 175? Where are the voice recorders from Flight 11 and 175? Why can't we gain access to the complete air traffic control records for Flight 11 and Flight 175? Where are the airport surveillance tapes that show the passengers boarding the doomed flights? When will complete passenger lists for all the flights be released? Why did your brother Jeb Bush, as Juan read, go to the offices of Hoffman Aviation School, order the flight records be removed?
There's a last one on there that I'm very troubled over with those questions. I'd like the remains of our loved ones brought to a rest in place here that we can all go and visit to try to heal instead of being over in this landfill over on one of the islands. I understand there are quite a few refrigerated tractor-trailer trucks where they say they can't identify. We need a resting place. I have nothing of my husband, and so do thousands of others have anything of their loved ones. We need that. It's 2.5 years. You know, yes, there is blame, and they're skirting around the truth, and we know the only way we're going to get it is through my lawsuit.
Ellen Mariani and Philip Berg, I want to thank you very much for being with us. When we come back,
thank you.
Gore Vidal, stay with us. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As we turn now to Gore Vidal, concerned about the events of September 11th and many of the unanswered questions, he has a new book out now. It's called Imperial America, Reflections on the United States of Amnesia. Gore Vidal, the author of 22 novels, 5 plays, many screenplays, more than 200 essays. His United States Essays, 1952 to 1992, is one of the great American books of the 20th century, won the National Book Award in 1993. I recently sat down with Gore Vidal to talk with him about where he was on September 11th.
Where was I? 911. I was south of Naples in a town called Ravello. And I turned on CNN, and the first thing I saw was a plane going into a tower. And I knew that something dreadful had happened.
And what were your thoughts as the hours unfolded?
Who? What? Why? I'm still wondering who, what, why, since nobody else bothers with those three questions. It's the only three questions which had ever bothered us. I assume it was Osama bin Laden, an Arabian. I assumed it was the people that they say were the hijackers, who are mostly Arabians from Saudi Arabia. And why? I've been trying to work out ever since. And what? I've been trying to work out. In a normal country, this would have all been investigated by the Congress, by our various secret services, police services. The United States is not a normal country. We're a homeland now, under military surveillance and military control. The president asked the Congress, right after 9/11, not to conduct a major investigation as it might deter our search for terrorism, wherever it may be in the world. So Congress obediently rolled over. There was, I remember, Pearl Harbor. I was a kid then. And within 3 years of it, I had enlisted in the Army. That's what we did in those days. We did not go off to the Texas Air Force and hide. I realize the country has totally changed, that the government is not responsive to the people, either in protecting us from something like 9/11, which they should have done, could have done, did not do, and then when it did happen, to investigate. So I wrote two little books, one called Perpetual War for Perpetual Peace, in which I try to go into the why. Osama bin Laden, if it were he or whoever it was, why it was done. Then I wrote another one, Dreaming War, on why we were not protected at 9/11, which ordinarily would have led to the impeachment of the President of the United States who had allowed it to happen. They said they had no information. Since then, every day, the New York Times prints another mountain of people who said they had warned the government. They had warned the government. President Putin of Russia, he had warned us. President Mubarak of Egypt, he had warned us. Three members of Mossad claimed that they had come to the United States to warn us that sometime in September, something unpleasant might come out of the sky in our direction. Were we defended? No, we were not defended. Has this ever been investigated? No, it hasn't. There was some attempt at the midterm election. There was a pro forma committee in Congress, which has done nothing thus far. What are we, 3 years later? This is shameful. The media, which is controlled by the great conglomerates, which control the political system, has done an atrocious job of reporting, though sometimes good stories get in. I've worn my eyes out studying the Wall Street Journal, which, despite its dreadful editorial policies, is a pretty good newspaper of record, which the New York Times is not. If you read the Wall Street Journal very carefully, you can pretty much figure out what happened that day. At the time of the first hijacking, according to law, FAA, it is mandatory within 4 minutes of a hijacking, fighter planes from the nearest airbase, military base, go up to scramble. That means go up and force the plane down, find out who they are, find out what's happening. For 1 hour and 50 minutes, I think it was, no fighter plane went up. During that hour and 20 minutes, we lost the two towers and one side of the Pentagon. Why didn't they go up? No description from the government, no excuse, a lot of mumbling stories which were then retracted and new stories replaced them. That, to me, was the end of the Republic. We no longer had a Congress which would ask questions, which it was supposed in place to do, of the executive. We have a commander-in-chief who likes strutting around in military uniform, which no previous commander-in-chief ever did, as they're supposed to be civilians, keeping charge of the military. This thing is surrealistic now, and it is getting nastier and nastier, as we are more and more kept in the dark about those things which most affect us, which are war and peace, prosperity and poverty. These are the main things that a government should look after, and we, the people, should be told about. We have been told nothing, and every voice is silent. So I wrote two little books, which were then noticed by people who like to look at the internet, and then a few hundred thousand people have bought them. And I don't come out with conspiracy theories. I never became a journalist. I'm a historian. Because journalists give you their opinions and pretend they're facts. I don't give you my opinions because they may be valuable to my mother, but they're of no value to anybody else. They may be of value to me. But I give the facts as I find them, and I list them, and they're quite deadly. This government is culpable of, if nothing less, negligence. Why were we not protected with all the air bases, fighter planes up and down the eastern seaboard? Not one of them went aloft while the hijackings took place. Finally, two from Otis Field in Massachusetts arrived at the Twin Towers, I think at the time the second one was hit. If anybody had been thinking, they would have gone on to Washington to try and prevent the attack on the Pentagon. They went back to Otis, back to Massachusetts. So I ask these questions, which Congress should ask, does not ask, which the press should ask, but it's too frightened. It's a reign of terror now.
A recent expose shows that even the congressional committee that's looking into this can't get a hold of documents that are classified, and even public testimony is now being reclassified.
Well, isn't it pretty clear that the dictatorship is in place? We're not supposed to know certain things, and we're not going to know them. They're doing everything to remove our history, to... They've damaged the Freedom of Information Act. Bush managed to have a number of presidential papers, including those of his father, put out of reach of historians or anybody for a great length of time, during which they will probably be shredded, so they will never be available. And what I've always called, jokingly, the United States of amnesia will be worse than an amnesiac. It'll be have suffered a lobotomy. There will be no functioning historical memory of our history.
How has George Bush accrued so much power?
Well, the election of 2000 was the end of the Republic. It was the second time it had happened that somebody who got the popular vote didn't get the election. 1876, when Governor Tilden, the Democrat of New York, won the election. But they were able, we still had troops in the South, they were able to turn the election around in the Electoral College. Tilden didn't want another civil war, so he just withdrew. But there was no sinister group taking charge. It was just a party group of Republicans who wanted to continue the reign of General Grant. That was mildly sleazy. This is major corruption. This is corporate America as one putting in place a president who was not elected, getting the Supreme Court to delay and delay, when under the 10th Amendment, every decision about the voting in Florida should be made by the Florida Supreme Court, not the U.S. Supreme Court, which the Constitution rules out in matters of election.
So how did that happen? And how did, well, isn't he your relative, Al Gore?
Well, there's nothing I go through the streets boasting of, no. But yes, he's my cousin. And very un-Gore. The Gores are very known for their belligerency. And he is not known for self-defense, let us say. He should have asked. It's easy to say he should have, but it was pretty clear at the time I would have had I been in that situation. Count the total Florida vote. He has every right to demand that. And they couldn't have played games because it's too big a vote. Instead, he asked, I think, three counties, Dade and Broward and one other, to do their count over again.
Concerned that he wouldn't win outside of those.
No, I think he figured that he had won those. Dade is certainly a large minority vote, which had all voted for him. There's a wonderful book by Nichols called Jews for Buchanan. And it's a marvelous shot of four Jewish gentlemen looking terribly alarmed. And you see Dade County goes for Buchanan. Even Buchanan said, look, this, these were not my votes down there. Something's wrong. And it was stolen by the Secretary of State, that lady who has now been rewarded with a seat in Congress, the president's brother, the losing president candidate's brother, was governor, and he took part in it. And the court did by 5-4. Two of the five should have recused themselves, should have just withdrawn from the case when Gore versus Bush came before the court. Why? One of them, Scalia, had a son who was working for the Bush team of lawyers before the Supreme Court. Does Justice Scalia recuse himself, as he should, because his son is arguing? No. He wants to kill Gore. He wants to make sure that the bad guys win. Thomas, wife, was busy getting curricula vitae of potential people to serve in a Bush administration. Clarence Thomas should have recused himself and withdrawn from the case. In which case, it would have been 4-3 for Gore, who would now be president, and Iraq and Afghanistan, I could guarantee, would not have been knocked down in order to benefit Halliburton and Bechtel.
Antonin Scalia recently went to Cleveland. He spoke at the Cleveland City Club, which is known as the oldest free speech forum in the country. He allowed no press in. And the night before, he spoke in the city, and he said that that vote, choosing George Bush, was his proudest moment.
I would impeach him. And in a well-run country, the Senate should make a movement toward the impeachment of, the trial of, anyway, of Justice Scalia. And back of that, there's some interesting organization going on, which is hard to determine, Opus Dei. Both Scalia and Thomas have connections with Opus Dei, which is a secret Catholic order, originally fascist. General Franco in Spain was a sort of godfather to it. And we don't know much about it. And it's all over the place, about 80,000 worldwide. Louis Free of the FBI at that time was a member, as was Mr. Hansen, the spy, who'd been giving all of our secrets to the, he was with the CIA. He'd been giving our secrets to the Russians for many years. I make no charges, but I simply bring up questions. Why not ask questions of these people? Does it suit Opus Dei that Bush is president? Now we're getting into God territory, which I normally would stay away from, as any good American should. It's not my business, other people's religions. But Bush is born again. That's why he uses biblical language. He's evil, he evil, he evildoer. Well, that's theological language. You can say he's a bad man, he's a dishonest man.
Gore Vidal. His latest book is Imperial America, Reflections on the United States of Amnesia, and that does it for today's program. I'll be in Chicago today, 12:30 Borders Books at 150 North State Street. Hope to see listeners and viewers. And then in Amherst on Saturday, 11 o'clock, Hampshire College commencement address, followed by Brattleboro at 2 p.m. at the River Garden, Montpelier Saturday night, and on Sunday at in Burlington. Check our website, democracynow.org, democracynow.org. Produced by Mike Berkshire, Hope Dokaduce, Anna Nagar, Elizabeth Press, John Hamilton, Jeremy Scahill, Mike DeFilippo, our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. You take it.